Hello, and thank you for having a listen or a watch to Secure Insights with NDK Cyber. Now, this week we're joined by Lucas Nelson, and Lucas is somebody that's got a pretty interesting journey. So they're a proud security practitioner and geek, as he puts it, turned VC. So we will talk through Lucas's experience and background and what got him to where he is today, but also we'll really delve into what it takes to operate in the VC world, both from looking at companies to invest in, what he looks for in new technology and new founders in these companies that have really cool design, right through to the more fundraising side of the VC world as well. So a really interesting one for me, something a bit different, something we don't see every day. So I hope you enjoy, and open to feedback as always.
Cool. Well, Lucas, thank you very much for joining me today. I know you're a busy guy. So I guess for those that don't know you, haven't seen your background, would you like to provide a brief background of who you are, what you do, and we can kick into some avenues from there?
Love to. So proud geek, as you can see in my background, if you can see, hacker turned VC. I broke into computers for a living for the better part of a decade. I then switched sides of the table, went to business school, joined a venture capital firm. I've been doing early stage cybersecurity investing for, I don't know, the better part of another decade. Which is a nice way of saying I've got experience in the cybersecurity space.
Yes, massively. And I think there's not many people out there, certainly that I'm aware of or spoken to, that have such in-depth experiences on both sides of the coin. So you packed a lot into, I don't know, a 15-second summary there. So to pull on a few threads then, so you were in cybersecurity previously. Let's go back 10, 15 years or so. You were with some big brand in the space. So what was your role in the cyber world before going VC?
Yeah. So then, yeah, I like these to be conversations as opposed to me monologuing at you for 15 minutes, which I can do. so I got into cybersecurity way back, let's say 1995, cool, in like high school. A little bit of misspent youth on bulletin boards and maybe breaking into my local college's computer Unix system for fun.
Allegedly.
Went to Purdue. Mostly because Eugene Spafford was there. Back in, let's call it 94, 95, he wrote the book on Unix security, practical Unix security. It was an O'Reilly book. And there were probably, if you went to the computer, like if you went to the computer section in a bookstore, it was one shelf, you know, 12, 15, 20 books. If there was a security book, it was his. I had a couple of friends who went to Purdue, other hackers. I visited them. I liked the school. It had a great engineering program. And Spafford was there. So I decided I'd do cybersecurity at Purdue back before that, you know, that you couldn't minor in cybersecurity. It wasn't really a thing. But he was the guy. And so that's, I went to Purdue for that. And then after graduating, because I didn't know any better, I wanted to go into startups, didn't know any better, so I moved to New York. Clearly the Valley was the right answer, but I didn't go that route. And I did a startup. We sold that quickly. Did another startup that got sold quickly as well. So about 2.5, 3 years in, I've sold a couple startups. And then I went and did a company called AtStake. AtStake was cybersecurity consulting. The crew of people that did the work there are kind of like a mini PayPal mafia for cybersecurity. They're the CISOs today of places like Google and Cisco. Alex Stamos from Apple's out of there. Netflix, like you name a tech company CISO. Well, that's not unfair, but a lot of tech company CISOs came out of this group. And so my superpower is those people still talk to me, I guess.
Okay, cool. Nice. So, I mean, going back even to 95, I mean, you speak to people now and you say, look, 10 years ago, cybersecurity is nowhere near what it is today. What was it in 95, 96?
It wasn't an industry back then. It was just like, again, there was like one book, right? But again, computers weren't really, so Netscape Navigator dropped in like 97, I want to say. Maybe 96, somewhere around there, right? Mosaic was 94, I want to say. So you go far enough back and there wasn't really an industry, so to speak. I guess Netscape really became big in 98, probably went public in 99, but maybe went public in 98. So cybersecurity wasn't something anyone did for a living, really. AtStake, which I went to, was one of the first computer security consulting firms out there. It was early, put it that way, maybe not the first, but it was definitely early. And, you know, getting 200 people together that could do cybersecurity was a big deal. Today it'd be a small shop, right? So better be lucky than good, right? Like I've been in an industry where every year it's bigger and more important than the last year. And it's been that way for 25, 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It must have been a hell of a ride coming through and up there. And you finished up with your security sort of practitioner career, I guess, with Symantec, right?
So At Stake got bought by Symantec. I want to say it was 05, give or take. You can find it on LinkedIn if you want to know the year. But they bought us. And like any, you go from a startup, which is chaotic and fun, to a regular company. And that's a pretty big awakening. Like, that's right. This is how the real world acts and so on and so forth. So I did that for a couple of years and then went to business school. After business school, I went out to the Valley for a year. Well, actually, for about 2 years. I spent a little bit of time, let's say 6 to 9 months, at a venture capital firm out there. Now, I graduated in 09. You want to pick a bad time to graduate from business school.
Just thinking that, yeah. Crikey.
Yeah, it was pretty nasty. Like, the year before, 95% of the graduates had job offers. My year was 75%. And the year after was 96%, right? So, like, mine is just this, you know, drop off a cliff. And I graduated wanting to do other stuff. And so I didn't have a job. So I went out to the Bay Area. I worked for a place called US Venture Partners, great venture capital firm. They do a bunch of cybersecurity investing. Hats off to those guys. And they were really kind to take me in, kind of, you know, as a venture associate. Here's a desk and a card, have fun. So I did that for about 6 months.
Yeah.
But they had just promoted two people, so there wasn't a spot for me there. So then I went to Adobe, and I ran Adobe's security development lifecycle team for another, let's say, year before another venture capital job opened up, and I moved back to New York.
Got it. So at that transition point, so Symantec have bought you. It's obviously not the same sort of thing you're into. Whatever happened there, that's fine. But what was it then of like, I'm going to go to business school? Because not everyone does that transition. That's a bold move in a lot of people's books.
So somewhere I've got the original journal I wrote this in. But okay. I was looking around. Once every couple of years, I pull my head up. I say, okay, where do I want to be in X years? Let's say 10 years, 20 years. And then I work my way backward. And I looked at what I was doing. And I was a security consultant, which means I was traveling, let's say, 30-40% of my time. As consulting goes, that's not much at all, right? That's pretty good. You're home, you know, kind of more nights than you're not. But you're still traveling a lot. And if you're relatively young, I was, you're getting paid pretty well. But if you want to get paid more, you need to work more hours, right? There's no, like, you're getting paid per hour. So there's no leverage there. So I kind of made this quadrant chart of like money versus time. And I figured if I wanted to make more money, I could spend more time. But if I was going to spend more time, I might as well spend time doing something that I was interested in. And I'd been at startups before. And if you're at a startup, the investors seem to have the best job in the world, right? Like, once in a while, they stop by. The founder runs out, makes a big deal about them. Like, who doesn't want to be that guy? Like, I want to go do that. And so I started kind of putting feelers out for, like, you know, what does it mean to be a VC? And it turns out my dad went to high school with an investor who had been on the Midas list. And so I won't name the guy, he reached out to him and said, like, hey dude, haven't seen you in 20 years since our last reunion. You know, would you talk to my son about venture capital for 20 minutes? And the guy did one better. He's like, hey, next time he's in town, I'll take him out to lunch. So this guy was on the Forbes list in the top 10, took me out to lunch, and basically said, don't go into venture investing. It's a terrible business. Here's all the reasons it's a bad idea. But if you're not going to listen to me, you probably should go to B-school because you don't know anything about finance. Like, I didn't know what a capital market was. Like, I just didn't know anything. And so that's, that sounds like a hill I want to climb. So I went to business school. with an eye towards getting into venture investing. And then I spent basically 2 years of business school trying to network my way into a job in venture capital. And that, you know, I got a job in venture capital probably 5 years after that. So it took business school plus another about 2 to 3 years before I actually had a job doing what I wanted to do. But that's how I made the transition.
Nice. Well, it's clearly paid off. And I guess with your route coming into that, having been on the other side of the fence, if you like, been a practitioner, been in the startups themselves, how much of your success in the VC world do you attribute to having been there and done it?
Well, you know, whether I've had success yet or not in the VC world remains to be seen, right? The problem with venture capital is your feedback loops are really slow.
Okay.
So I've made 7 to 10 venture investments, and I'll tell you 3 or 4 years whether those were good, bad, or great. This is a bit controversial. Right now, the last decade, maybe more, of venture capital has been about being founder friendly and being a practitioner, right? And so you talk about, you know, founders fund, but A16Z, you know, have made this the general zeitgeist of, to be a good investor, you have to have been in the trenches before, you have to be technical. And I've benefited from that, in that when I go out and fundraise in the world, people say, oh, he matches the things that these other funds say you should do. I'm not sure that's true. If you like, having done it, having broken into computers for a decade, I don't think makes me a better investor. Okay. I know the cybersecurity market really, really well, but there are plenty of people coming out of other, you know, sales and banking and whatever that know the market. I think I do have an advantage in two spots. I can spot bad technology easily.
Okay.
Right? So that helps. Now, most VCs can spot bad technology or get someone else to tell them that it's bad technology, right? So that might save me a little time. And the other one, I think, where it helps is, having been there, done that, it does make it easier to win deals. Those are probably the actual honest pieces. There's a bit of, if you know the market cold, then you can go earlier than everybody else, because you know when, like, oh, that's an unserved market need, I know that exists. So if you only do cybersecurity, or you only do, I don't know, pickleball investing,
you're
going to be able to win those deals better than a generalist. So that helps.
And is that because the founders of these businesses or the staff there are, okay, we trust these guys, they're coming in with a real bank of knowledge? Is that?
There's some amount of that. There's a couple of things. You can go earlier, so you see it before other people see it.
Right? Okay.
So there's been times where other investors are like, I don't understand why you find this interesting. Right? Like, well, okay. And you know the industry well enough that doesn't scare you, right? So I can't do that when we talk about a photo sharing app, right? Like, no, I have no idea why one is better than the other. But if you show me something in cybersecurity, I'd be like, okay, this has been done 4 times. Here's why it hasn't worked in the past. Here's probably why it probably still won't work. Or no, this is fundamentally different for this reason, right? Like, you fixed the cost structure problem or whatever. And then, yeah, founders do tend to like investors they think can help put their thumb on the scale. Part of being able to do that for me is, yeah, I know the market well. I can steer you in the right direction. So that's helpful. And then I know a bunch of CISOs from interesting places, and that's another place where I can put my thumb on the scale, right?
I was going to ask this. So, yeah, having a network of people here, I don't know whether this is the right turn of phrase, but almost having sort of an off the record discussion with X, Y, and Z CISOs about this particular product, would that be useful to you? Is that something that happens and goes on, or is it all done in a very official capacity?
Oh, no. I mean, off the record makes it sound nefarious or something, but
yeah, probably haven't phrased that correctly, but you know.
Yeah. So let me put it this way. We've got, in for the fund, let's say 10 to 12 CISOs who help us out with the fund, and right, they're advisors of the fund. I've got a bunch of other friends I can call for various things and say, hey, I'm looking at this thing. Is it interesting or not? And then, I guess last but not least, and this is true of any sort of in-group. If you're into a certain type of technology, you can easily make friends with other people that are into the same type of technology, right? Like, not all people are going to like all people, fine. But if I can go deep on something that you can go deep on, mm-hmm. you're way more likely to have interesting conversations with that person than if it's all just superficial, like, how do you talk, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm friends with a bunch of CISOs because, yeah, we're going to talk about the same nerdy security stuff. We know the same people. The industry gossip is interesting to both of us. Cybersecurity used to be a small niche thing. It used to be tiny, right? When DEF CON was 150 people. Now it's 100 times that, right? So today, but if you go back to that original 150 people, they all wanted to be there, and they all know each other now because it's been 30 years of running around the same groups. So I think that's, you know, just the thing about getting older in a network, right? And again, I got lucky. The network I chose has been bigger and more important every year for 30 years, right? Compounding interest. If you, you know, if you were got really into, oh, I don't know, the wrong type of language. If you're really into Lisp, right? The Lisp programming language. If you're like, that group is the same size as it was 30 years ago, right? Yeah. You may know everybody in there, but that's not going to be professionally particularly helpful to you.
So you touched on a few points here, and you're spotting bad technology. Okay, fine. Let's not dive into that, because what makes good technology, or what do you look for in an organization that you go, you know what, that I can see myself getting behind that. I can see myself investing in this.
Yeah. So we go pretty early at Lytical Ventures, right? So we're putting money in it pre-seed, seed, series A. So kind of pre-product market fit.
Okay, cool.
So a lot of it is the same thing everyone's going to be interested in. Great founders. You always want great founders, right? You know, a bad team can ruin a great idea really easily.
Cool. So what is on that point there, what is a great founder for you? Is there a particular, is it a personality thing? Is it a background? Is it, what sort of puts that piece together?
It's not a background. That's for sure. I mean, there are backgrounds that are more common, but I'm not going either on the one side, oh, that person comes from Stanford, I'm in.
Cool. Okay.
Or, oh, that person comes out of this military unit, I'm in, right? Yeah. So it's not background. For me, you know, a willingness to listen and learn, okay. right? Kind of curiosity is one of those things, because it's easy when things are going well. Hey, things are going well. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. When things go poorly, what do? What's your fallback position?
Okay.
And generally, a good fallback position when things are going poorly is, okay, let me figure out why they're going poorly. Let me get curious about that, and then I'll try to fix it. A less good way is, I'm just going to try harder to do the thing that's not working. So people that can hear tough feedback and think it through and come back and say, yep, that was good feedback, or no, actually, that's wrong, and here's why. That's what I like. And, you know, a lot of people can fake that in an hour-long pitch meeting. So, you know, it does get harder to know when someone's just saying the right things versus they actually believe them. Some amount of, you know, just emotional intelligence, you know, EQ type stuff matters. I tend to like technical founders, right? Okay. So if you give me someone who did 30 years in sales, they can BS me and I can't tell whether they're giving me the number, sandbagging, or give me the rosy version, right? If you give me a technical founder, 95% of the time, I know, like, when they say stuff, I'm like, ah, that's what they mean, right? They mean this. They might be sandbagging, but I can read that from a technical person, whereas from a salesperson, they probably have the same tells. Well, they probably have tells. I just can't read those tells. Where with an engineer, I can read the tells.
Got it, understood. And a lot of what you're saying there sort of it chimes me with what we do. You know, it's almost like an interview in a way, these pitch meetings. So how would one of those sort of pitches get to you, as it were? Do you approach them? Do they approach you? Is there sort of networks? Is there no sort of structured route in?
There's common paths, but there's no structure. Okay. Right. So there are better ways, but there's no right way. Mm-hmm. So the best way in is one of my advisors, friends, founders calls me and says, you got to take a look at this. I think they're great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to do that in a heartbeat. The hardest path in is you just blindly email me and say, hey, I saw that you did this deal. I think you'd be a good investor for me. right?
As blunt as that, and that happens.
That happens all the time.
Okay, cool.
The times it doesn't work is when you use the wrong deal, right? Like, hey, I saw you did, you know, this thing in pickleball. I think you'd be a great investor in gaming. Like, nope. Because there are, you know, people have form stuff, right? Like AI is getting better, but it still does that. But if someone says, you know, I saw you invested in Wicker, I'm doing something in this area, and I think you'd be helpful or be interested. Okay, that took some thought. I'll you know, read through it. But yeah, I mean, my favorite stories are one of my advisors calls me and says, you know, this thing is awesome. Great, can you make the intro? I don't know them, I just think it's awesome. I'm like,
yeah,
all right, I'll go hunt that down then, right?
Very that's just,
well, when one of my advisors doesn't even know them and thinks it's awesome, they must really like it. Versus, oh, I went to culinary school with this person and they're great, you should talk to it. Like, oh, okay, you owe them a favor, cool. Yeah.
I see. And so you get in there super early, like you said there. So if it's, say, a product company, for example, is the product at sort of a finished stage here, or do you help sort of guide and develop and get it to the next, sort of, I guess, profitable stage?
Yeah, so they're almost never finished.
Okay,
so
cool.
When we invest, I like to see at least a prototype. I like it running at least in dev somewhere, right? So someone's kicked the tires on it. Have I gone earlier than that? Sure, but it's not where I like to play. I like to say, okay, you've got a beta with somebody, cool, I can see it working. But what's the right way of putting this? It's not that I don't help with product.
Okay.
I'm not taking any credit for helping with product, if that makes sense. Like, if you're getting product ideas from me, you've got problems.
Okay. Right? Like,
you should know more than your VC about your product. So, you know, like, I'm never going to say, like, oh, that button should be over there. Does it mean I don't have good ideas from time to time? Sure. But the most helpful I think I've been is in guiding of technology, i.e., someone will say, hey, I'm looking, you know, we want to make this product, but we haven't found a good solution technology wise for this. So one of my companies said, hey, we'd like to make a kind of a secure communications layer for this, but none of the VPN technology we've seen is any good. And I'll be like, oh, well, have you seen WireGuard? I haven't seen WireGuard. Go look at WireGuard. Right. They come back like, that's perfect. That's exactly what I was looking for. Done. Right. So I didn't steer them on anything. I merely have a pretty broad view of the market. So I can say, oh, here's some technologies you may not have run across that I have. Now, this was back before WireGuard was kind of famous. Like, now everyone knows WireGuard. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you should. It's great. It really is better technology. Mm-hmm. But I saw it early, and so I could tell another company about it. Like, oh, you should look at this thing that these other people are using. But yeah, I'm not generally telling them like, oh yeah, you need to do that, blah. I don't know. Sorry, I've got a little bit of a cold, so I'm coughing a little bit. I'm trying to hydrate up so I don't cough.
You and me both. The UK has just descended into true winter. You know, it's gone from a elongated summer to winter time. So we're all full of that here as well, don't worry. But so say this company, I've got this product, it's sort of prototype-esque sort of stage. What are the things that, you know, would really benefit me coming to that first meeting, maybe second meeting with someone like yourself, with the goal of getting good investment and getting you on board? What do I need to make sure I'm ticking?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different things you want to bring to the table, right? So you're gonna pitch. You're gonna pitch a VC. You need about 10 slides. If you don't know what 10 slides they are, Google Guy Kawasaki's 10 slides.
Okay.
His are as good as any, but you need about 10 slides. You know, who's the team? What's the problem? What's the solution? So and so.
Mm-hmm.
What gets VCs excited generally is traction, right? Like, hey, I've got 8 people using it. They love it. Okay, that takes a lot of guesswork out of it for me. So tracking is the easiest thing. If you don't have that, then it's all kind of derivatives of that. Signs that you're on the right track.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a massive market. That's what you always want. So sorry.
No, you're good, man. No worries.
Massive market's always good. Good technology, right? What makes good technology? Something novel. There's something different about your approach than everybody else's. You're not just a wrapper around somebody else's technology.
Yeah.
So we've seen a bunch of AI companies.
I was going to ask you about this. The rise of everyone's got now, and even in the recruitment space, for example, every tool that we've traditionally used has now a new shiny AI component that seems to be a derivative of ChatGPT or similar, you know?
So the problem with that is that there's a whole bunch of companies that were developed as a wrap around GPT, not ChatGPT, but GPT, that ChatGPT just decimated, right? So do they still exist? Sure. But there were tools for like, hey, I'm going to copy edit your Facebook ads. Okay. But ChatGPT does that for free. So why am I paying you? I'm going to help you write a blog post. Okay. The tools that help you do that are better than ChatGPT at doing it. But I mean, I'm not going to pay you $1,000 a year for that. I'm not paying you $100 a month for that. Like, I can get that for free or, you know, close to it with ChatGPT. So there were, you know, there were these massive value props that were just decimated, undercut when ChatGPT came out and made it like trivially easy to do those things. And so if you're making your own models, that's probably valuable. Now there's open questions to what model is going to be superior. So this is the problem with AI investing right now, is the large language models, the really big ones, right now are dominating smaller, more specialized models. Okay. So you said, oh, I've got all the recruitment data in the world. I'm going to make a tool for recruiting. Odds are GPT-4 still does a better job than your model.
Wow.
Right? You've got all the recruiting data, but it's got like all the world's data. And it turns out there's enough factors in recruiting that are world data that you don't have that make their data set better than all of your recruiting data, right?
Wow.
So that's the, now there's some papers out there saying, nope, I can make smaller models that are much more efficient than ChatGPT and are 95% as good. Okay, if I can do 95% of the work for 10% of the price, maybe that's a better model. But the technology is moving so quickly back and forth, I don't think anyone knows where it's going to end up. I'm sure somebody knows where it's going to end up landing. I'm sure there's another expert that thinks the opposite of that. And we don't know which one of those two people is right until they're proven correct over time.
I got you. I was going to ask then, so like, is there ever going to be any room for the little guy, so to speak, or is it always going to be dominated by the big players? But we'll find out in what, 5, 10 years?
Something like that. I mean, so my partner, Steve, does a lot of deep thinking on kind of AI in that space. So I do more cyber. He does more AI. We both cross over. But his belief right now is no wrappers, right? That's pretty easy. Look for vertical solutions where a differentiated data set really does matter, right? And there's places we believe that to be true. I'll give you an example. We just invested in a AI tax prep company. And like, yep, like that's a space where knowing all that data really matters. Maybe ChatGPT will become as good as this thing, maybe not. There's a whole bunch of reasons that we think no, but doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, selling to that ecosystem is the key. And these people know how to do that piece of it, right? How to be supportive of current tax prep people as opposed to trying to disintermediate them. Again, I'll tell you in 5 years if our thesis there is correct.
Yeah.
But it's at least a neat thesis. It's a good way of thinking about the world rather than, hey, this thing does a whiz-bang thing. Let's hope that ChatGPT doesn't do that thing next month.
Got it. Okay, cool. So we've got your slides. You come to the investor meeting, you get your slides set up, you've got traction, you've got some hard numbers to go with it. The tech's pretty novel. Anything else we need to account for, or is that the magic combination?
So the way you should think about venture investing, so I'm going to answer this in a different way, but I think it'll be more useful to people listening, is VCs are trying to take as much risk off the table as they can at any given investment stage. Right. So what types of risks are there? There's technology risk, there's market risk, there's team risk, and there's funding risk. Those are the four I think about. There's probably others,
okay,
but let's start with those four. Like other risks might be legal risks, right? Like, hey, you're doing something illegal.
Right.
Like, so there, Uber would be a good example of legal risk. So you have to, so I want to take as many of those off the table as I can. So if you come in with a world-class team,
mm-hmm,
and a big market and great technology, and you've already started to sell it, you've taken most of those risks off the table.
Mm.
If you come in with amazing technology, but you're a solo founder, okay, there's still team risk. Can you build a team around yourself that will do the thing, right? Mm. Because if it turns out you can't work with anybody, I don't care how brilliant you are, you're not creating a company with any meaningful size or value, right? So, you know, are you in an unfundable space? That happens from time to time, right? Where before cannabis became the big thing, most funds couldn't put money into that. So, you know, your funding risk was large there. Oh, I don't know how you're going to get the next dollar from anybody, because if I give you $2 million, there's no one else who's going to invest in a cannabis company, right? Go Once ahead. The legal risk got taken away, cannabis funds came about, and then that risk was wildly diminished. But, you know, anything that's really cutting edge and new, cyber generally isn't in this space. You know, frontier tech, funding risk becomes a thing, right? If you're the first person to put money into SpaceX or either of those, right? You know, electric cars weren't a thing. Private space flight wasn't a category. And so it's hard to get those initial things. Once Tesla kind of, you know, does their fourth launch and proves it's possible, money floods into that market. But prior to that, getting VCs to invest in SpaceX was difficult. So
It's the sort of, you almost need a guinea pig to prove it to be done.
Yeah.
But then I guess the flip side of that is, if you don't get there first and early, you don't get as much of the rewards. Would that be fair?
Well, first mover advantage, you can, sometimes it works out, right? Sometimes a land grab and the first person to get there is the winner. But Facebook wasn't the first social network, for example.
That's true, yeah.
So first mover advantage is usually illusory, right? Not always. But to be fair, Tesla is Tesla because of amazing performance by the team, and Elon or not, in creating an amazing product. They could have easily opened up the funding route and then stumbled, and Rivian could have been the answer, right? Or Fisker or whomever else. And that happens also quite often. You know, there were a bunch of networking companies before Cisco, right? They weren't the, you know, the obvious choice there, for example.
Got it. Yeah. I just think, as a consumer, you know, electric cars, for example, I don't know an awful lot about that industry, but I only know Tesla as the brand. But like you say, there's maybe a few more to go before that, but we just wouldn't have heard of them because of X, Y, and Z. Makes sense. Okay. Cool. And we've touched on a few sort of different trends of what we're seeing at the moment, but is there any particular trend that's standing out? I know we touched on AI, but are you seeing a lot of requests for pitches from a particular type of product or type of widget, industry, service?
So our view on AI is a pretty simple one. Right now, you could have an AI fund, you could do AI investing, but that's like doing mobile investing just after the iPhone.
Okay. Right?
Nowadays, you don't mobile invest, you just invest in companies because of course they're on mobile. AI is going to do the same thing. In our first fund, which we finished investing for early this year, let's say Jan-Feb of this year, we've got 15 companies, a handful of which are using AI, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say 5 of 15. I might be off by one or two either way. We believe that in fund two, every company has to have an AI story. They're going to be using AI for something.
Mm.
It's just too ubiquitous not to use. So saying you're an AI investor, doable for the next couple of years, 5 years from now, yeah, of course you've got some sort of AI built in. The same way, of course, you have a mobile app that works with your service or what have you. Like, who doesn't? So it won't be a differentiator for long.
Understood. Okay, cool. And so with that then, is there anything that's like really standing out as like the next trend or something you're seeing an awful lot of to sort of accompany the AI move? I think AI over sort of shadows everything really with all the news stories. It's all AI, AI, AI. This tool is AI, like you say. But is there anything else in there that's sort of coming up of maybe like the cloud was a few years back and things like that?
So I've got a few thoughts. Like for things that are on the horizon, they're still coming at us. IoT is still a problem that isn't a technology that isn't yet a cybersecurity problem, but is going to be, right? So I, in the past, I had CISOs say like, do I even care about my protecting the TVs on my network? Maybe not, but you will, right? Sooner or later, having unsecured things on your network just won't fly anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's a you know, future problem that you can see coming. Kubernetes, future problem. Like there are a couple companies out there that do Kubernetes security, but it's not like, oh, that's a solved problem and we know who's the winner. No, mm-hmm. like that's still a space that's open. What I'm seeing in the market right now, there's this pendulum that swings back and forth between best in breed and best in suite, right?
Okay.
So best in breed is pretty obvious. I want the best thing to do email security. I want the best firewall. I want to just knock it all down and then you try to stitch it all together.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Best in suite for a long time, I'll argue, is Palo Alto, right? They've got all the things you need. And so if you're just going to buy one set of products, you're going to buy Palo and that's going to be good enough.
So that's your one-stop shop, if you like.
Yeah, and there's always one or two vying for supremacy there. I think Palo is at the apex on the way down.
Okay.
I think Microsoft with bundling is going to eat a bunch of people's lunches right now, right? So if I'm out there, I don't want to be under Microsoft's elephant feet right now, mm-hmm. right? So Defender, better than good enough. It's actually pretty good, you know, for Windows for sure. Sentinel, right? You get free data ingest. So this is their bundling play. They can undercut price. Do I think that's fair? Probably not, but I think it's legal. So it is what it is.
Fair versus legal, sure.
So, you know, do I want to be Splunk? Well, okay, Splunk just got bought. So yeah, I'm pretty happy to be Splunk this week. But, you know, did Splunk decide to sell because they saw the writing on the wall that like, Microsoft is giving Splunk away for free, right? You buy your E5 license, you get Sentinel, you get Defender. I don't know that I want to be CrowdStrike this week, right? It's hard to compete with free.
Mm-hmm.
The CIO says, wait, I can, you know, get all, I can pay for all my Microsoft licenses by getting rid of these two products. Done, right? So that's where I see the best in suite part of the industry going.
Mm-hmm.
But for startups, they don't care. Right? Like Microsoft is not going to get good at Kubernetes security in the next 2 years. That's not their thing. So there's plenty of other places to be playing, but you just don't want to be underfoot when that happens. You know, I probably don't want to be Palo this week, right? Microsoft is going to be, you know, making moves. They're not technology based, right? It's bundling and pricing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so like that's what I see in the industry. For things I want to be playing with, yeah, using AI to, there's 3 million open jobs in cybersecurity, give or take. And let's say 1 to 2 million of those are in the US.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, like, yeah.
Different people's data says different stuff. Should we get rid of the tier one stuff using, you know, AI? Yeah, probably, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can't hire those people anyway. So a crappy AI solution is better than no solution. And if AI turns out to be better than humans, even better, right? So like that seems like an obvious place to be playing, and you know, I think a bunch of different people are going to make a run at that. Again, the question is, are you just a wrapper? Oh, well, that's actually not all that interesting, right? Because then Microsoft will stick GPT into Sentinel and blow you up. But if you're doing more than that, if you really understand the business, you know, that you're going after, So, you know, maybe you don't go after the SME that Microsoft already handles really well. Maybe it's enterprise, or maybe it's MSSP or other things where, no, you have to have non-Windows answers to these questions. Ah, okay, that's a good place to be.
You have a differentiator. It goes back to what you're saying about being novel and having a differentiator, I guess. Yeah, sure. And on the you touched on it there, the IoT, the OT security space, that seems to be a sort of something that's really on the rise at the moment. You know, there was a few key players maybe 2 or 3 years ago that came out with a and seemed to sort of get there first to a degree, but there's a lot of energy going into this space at the moment. It seems like the sort of the sleeping dragon's woken up a little bit, and everyone's going, oh, hang on, like you say, the TVs are now much more of a concern than maybe they were certainly 5 years ago.
Yeah, so the thing about, so IoT and OT are similar but different. So let's take them separately.
Sure.
When I think of IoT, I think of, we don't know what the problem's going to look like yet, right? Okay. So right now, I don't know, let's say 50% of TVs are smart TVs. That's going to go to 100%. Fine. We just don't know what the problem's going to look like until you see IoT kind of pushed out. Adoption is what, 30% maybe, right? Yeah. When adoption hits 70%, 80%, then you're going to see the real problems. So like, I don't think we're there yet on IoT. OT is a different story, where the adoption like is there, and the problem is just big and hairy and weird. Meaning, you've got things connected to the internet that were never supposed to be connected to the internet. Period. Full stop in the story. If you know the SCADA protocol, that this is the protocol that these energy systems use, your dam uses it to open and close valves, whatever, gas pipelines use it. It literally doesn't have a concept of administrator versus user. Right? There's no security built in at all. Like, it sees a command, it's like, oh, I should do that command. There's no question of authorization, authority, that sort of thing. These things were just built before that was a concept. And you don't really want to mess with your dam, right? Like, no, I don't really want to like accidentally have it go offline. And so those are big problems, because the willingness to touch the systems is low. The economic cost to screw them up is high. So far you've got a bunch of kind of passive systems that watch stuff and say, hey, we think there's a problem there. But that's not really the way you want to do it, right? You don't just want a, like a security guard walking around the perimeter. You want a wall around the perimeter. That's a bad metaphor, but you get it. I'll give you a fun story. Back when I worked for a living, so we would do these penetration tests, scans. We had a friend, one of the people in my firm in that stake, went to a bottling plant, right, for either Pepsi or Coke, I forget which one. And they ran a port scan, which literally just opens up a connection to each port number on each machine and says, anybody there? And then goes on to the next one. That's it.
So fairly it's standard.
What's that?
A fairly standard process, right?
Yes, very standard. It's akin to having somebody knock on the door of every house on a block and just see if anyone lives there, right? That's and it turns out this bottling machine hung. When the port got opened, it was like waiting for command. And the port never got closed, so it just sat there waiting. And we took down a bottling plant for, like, let's say an hour. I forget the exact number. And, the things that MBAs are really good at, right, the business of business, is knowing exactly how much you lost with an hour of downtime. So they could tell us, like, down to the penny, yeah, you guys cost us $4 million, blah, 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 and 75 cents. Like, you know, be school. That was the last time we scanned an industrial system. The next time we had an industrial system, we're like, no, we're not going to do that because we don't want $4 million of downtime. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Because you can't even go like get an inventory of what's there. So nowadays, what you do is you watch the traffic and passively hope that everything says something. But if you've got a dark machine that just doesn't wake up for 2 weeks, you just don't know it's there.
That's crazy. Yeah, I guess you can't sort of build like a tester environment of like another factory, you know, next door.
Yeah, you want an extra $500,000 machine over there? Like, no, not gonna happen.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that's probably speaks for itself, and that's a space to watch and a solution that needs looking at, I guess. And so I guess for people listening that might be on the other side of the coin of thinking, you know, do I go down the VC route? It's not all about just in sort of, you know, identifying these companies. There's the fundraising side of what you do as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a whole spiel about why going to venture capital is not a great career path, at least for young people. So
but you had this speech. Anyone, well.
Was that?
but you had the speech given to you about why you shouldn't go into it. And
yes. And I will point out that I was much older by the time, I was at least 7 years older by the time I made the switch.
Fair.
I'll give you a quick version of it. And the quick version is you walk in to talk to a CEO, right? They think about their problem all day long. Why should they listen to you? And my entire career for the last decade now has been making better and better answers to that question. Well, you should listen to me not because I have money. That's because every VC has money, but because I know these top five CISOs, you know, the CISO of this major tech firm, this one will all take my calls. You can go, you know, call them now if you want and see if I'm a good person, right? Those are the type of things that move the needle. And when you're young, the odds that you are in close with 10, 15, 20 CISOs, pretty small, right? Possible, but small. So age helps a lot just because your friends have all become older and more important positions. Great.
Fair enough.
So yeah, like identifying the best companies isn't generally the hard part, right? Winning deals is a lot harder. And you could just overpay, but that kind of just makes you a sucker, right? Like if you're just willing to pay the highest price. And by the way, the best people don't want that. They want someone who can help them, right? Well, I know I don't know everything. I want to give help. Okay, so that's the story on why going to venture capital young is generally not a great idea. I've done my spiel. Fundraising. The other thing you need to be able to do, arguably the only thing you need to be able to do to be a VC is fundraise, right? Let me be clear, returning more money than you've taken in is the job. But if people want to make an uneconomic decision and keep giving a fund that loses money, they could, and you'd still be a VC, right? So you have to be able to go out and fundraise. What does that mean? Well, you need to convince other people either via track record. Hey, here's the deals I've done and proof that I've made money in the past. You should believe I'll continue to do that and make money in the future. So that's part of it. Part of it is show why you're going to continue to win. Yep, I still know the CISOs at these 12 places. They still take my calls. They send me the companies they like, and those companies are going to outperform in the future, right? Like those are the stories you need to be able to tell. Fundraising is hard. It just always is, right? Asking other people for money is never an easy task. And then there's the integrity and the team risk, right? So people who invest in us, in our fund, in Lytical, go through the same kind of ranking of risk that we go through when we look at companies, right? So there's team risk, right? Will Steve and Lucas still get along 3 years from now? And there, you know, there are some famous places where that risk has been problematic.
Yeah.
There's funding risk. Will other people give these guys money, right? Because I don't want to be, you know, there's generally a point where you can close on a fund. So you're not allowed to close on the first dollar. You can only close when you're at 50% of your money or so.
Okay, cool.
So like you can take that one off the table. But that, you know, some people will go in and say, nope, here's money, go. I believe you'll raise the rest. What other risks are there? Then there's, you know, the same deal sourcing risks, right?
Yeah.
Are you in a sector? Are you in a market that's going to, you know, go down or go up, right? We've been an AI fund. AI has been part of our story. We're not an AI fund. AI has been part of our story since 2017, 2018, or 2018, 2019, when we first raised. Now, they do AI, but everybody does. So, you know, early on, we had to explain it. Now we don't have to explain it. In the future, we won't even have to talk about it anymore. But, you know, cybersecurity, do you believe that's going to be more important 5 years from now than it is today? We're a good bet. Do you believe that all of a sudden that problem's going to go away? We're a bad bet. I think it's a sort of a no-brainer that cybersecurity is going to be more important for a while. But there'll be a time in the future where it's no longer growing. Right now, it's, you know, the CAGR on it's still pretty darn good. 3 to 5 times the growth rate of the economy. That's a good place to be investing. But that won't always be true, right? Sooner or later, you're going to get to a steady state where it grows with the economy. And it's harder to make money. You know, it's easier to make money when you're growing really fast. This is.
Yeah, no, I agree, So it's almost like you've got to have like a sales spin to what you do, as well as the spotting the good companies and everything else in between.
Being a venture firm is interesting because, at least being a new firm, you're a startup, right? You're trying to do all the same things startups do. Find your customers, you know, make a compelling value proposition, right? And in the venture world, it's seen as a little bit gauche to talk about it that way, because, you know, we're supposed to be saving the world and helping founders. And let me be clear, I don't know if we're saving the world. We should be helping founders. But at the end of the day, your job is to compound capital, right? And, you know, no one likes to talk about that part of the job because it's way less nice than I'm going to invest in electric car companies and make the world greener. That's a much nicer story. But your job is to compound capital. And so if you have to find a way of doing that. And if you're investing in places that grow faster than the economy, your odds are better.
Yeah, understood. I think I've learned a lot today just speaking through this, talking through this, but I think there's a lot more to it than maybe people would sort of see from the outside in. And maybe the VC firms are sometimes seen as the good guys, the bad guys, and everything else in between, depending on your experiences with them. But thank you for sharing all that. We've darted around a few different places there. So hopefully there's been some good value taken from it for the listeners here. And just finally, what are you excited about the next 6-12 months or so?
So I'm about to make an investment in an AI forward company that helps tier one SOC analysts. Nice. So I think that's really exciting. Cool. So like, I like what's happening in the AI part of cyber. I think it's going to be really exciting. And then I've got a couple of companies that I invested in, let's say 3-4 years ago. They're just starting to make the turn, right? Like all of a sudden they're starting to become really well known, and that's fun. Like helping them with that set of problems of growth are fun problems. So those are the places that I'm most excited about. And then in, you know, kind of the cybersecurity area, I'm still looking at things for Kubernetes. I'm still looking at IoT and OT problems. So, you know, if your listeners are solving those problems, I'd love to hear from them.
And you've got a Lytical Thoughts newsletter type thing. Like, I get it. It's pretty useful. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for plugging that for me, actually. On our website, you can sign up for Cyber Thoughts. It's a monthly newsletter. We pen a kind of, you know, opening of what we think is happening in the cybersecurity and AI world. I think it's, you know, relatively interesting, but I write it. So I hope I think it's interesting. Low volume. So the signal noise should be pretty high.
Yeah, no, I get it monthly. It's one of these where you can just read it. It's casual. It's not sort of too much to digest all in one go. So yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Thank you again for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And
thank you for having me on. Thank your listeners for making it this far. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Take it easy. Have a good one.